Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to The Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to The Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and if you are new here, this is where we take a deep dive into the entertainment industry to provide you with valuable insights and entertaining stories. This week, we get to talk with one of Nashville's finest session musicians. We get to talk with Charles Judge. We'll talk to him about how his time in LA prepared him for Nashville, what it was like to work with artists like Tim McGraw, Faith Hill, and Taylor Swift, and we'll take a deep dive into his time working with Keith Urban. Now, I've had the pleasure of working with Charles several times throughout my time in Nashville, and he's not only an amazing talent, but he's a great guy, and I can't wait to catch up with him tonight. So if you'd like to join in, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. Charles, sir, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing, Jay?
I am very good, sir. I am happy to have you here. It's been a long time, and I would just love this opportunity to catch up a little bit.
Yeah, thanks for thinking of me, man.
Well, let's just jump right in. Let's just start off with, you know, how you get started. How did you get an interest in the music industry?
Oh, man. Well, my dad was a keyboardist. He, not professionally, although he played some gigs on the weekend and stuff, played organ at church, stuff like that. He had perfect pitch. His day gig was a computer programmer for NASA and guidance systems for Gemini and Apollo missions and stuff. But there was always a piano around the house. And so I was the oldest sibling in my family. And I was just naturally drawn to playing the keyboard. And he would show me little, you know, left hand bass lines to play while he was playing. And so I kind of got started there. I took a few lessons and eventually got serious about it, went to college at North Texas in Denton and studied music, got a degree there in composition and studied a lot of classical piano and arrangements and orchestration, electronic music, all kinds of stuff. And it was really an amazing environment, and I met a lot of great musicians there and sort of started a little band. We kind of played our own kind of fusion-y music. And then when I graduated, I went on the road with the band, and, you know, we just played disco and funk and jazz and pop music of the day. This is, gosh, back in the, shudder to think how long ago that was, back in the late 70s. But eventually we got sick of being on the road, and we had stopped in Tucson, Arizona, and it was November there. It was just gorgeous, and we all just decided, gosh, you know, let's stay here and just get off the road. And we started playing little jazz fusion gigs around town. And it was such a cheap place to live. We actually made a living doing that. And there was a couple of recording studios there. And it was kind of a very small pond. I was one of the few fish in that pond. So I got some opportunities to get recording experience there. We met a producer in town who kind of latched onto us, and we got to record a bunch of material as a band, but then he did a lot of jingles and other things and recorded other bands as well. So I kind of got to get my feet wet in a very friendly, you know, non sort of threatening studio environment. And it was just a wonderful experience. So that after doing that for 2 or 3 years, I made the jump to LA, and I was working at Guitar Center selling synths, you know, and hoping to get a gig or a session or something. And one day a writer-producer came in who was looking to buy a synthesizer. And at the time, you know, the two behemoths of analog synths back then were the Prophet 5 and the Oberheim OB-8. And he was, you know, hey, man, I can't decide which one to get. Can you kind of show me a little bit of stuff on each one of these? And I, you know, I was always the kind of guy that loved to program my own sounds and stuff. And so I very happily showed him, okay, here's a Prophet, and here's how you make a string sound on that, and here's how you do this and that, and here's the OB-8. And after a minute, I think I probably overwhelmed him a little bit, too much information, but he kind of said, well, what are you doing on Saturday? You know? And I said, well, nothing. And he invited me to come do a recording session with him. And he was, turned out he was not only singer-songwriter, but he had a lot of jingle clients, and he was kind of working his way up the ranks in that world. And so he hired me to come play all day on Yellow Pages commercials, which, what the heck is Yellow Pages? But anyway, so that kind of led one thing to another, and he started having success. I know he originally wanted to move to L.A. to become an artist, probably, but that wasn't really taken off for him. However, he had some friends up in the Bay Area that he was where he was from that knew Stevie Nicks and other people, and one thing led to another, and he got a song to Stevie Nicks that she really liked, and next thing you know, he was recording a big chunk of an album of hers called Rock a Little, and so he dragged me along as a keyboardist, and there I was, you know, all of a sudden playing on a big Stevie Nicks record, and his name was Rick Knowles, and he's still around doing it, cool guy, and he started working with Belinda Carlisle, so we made records with her, and it just, one thing led to another. I ended up working on a lot of pop and rock records in L.A. in the 80s, basically. So I got a lot of studio experience then. And, you know, growing up as a kid, I always read album credits just voraciously. I was just so enamored and so fascinated with that world. I just really wanted to be in that world, and I would read those credits and go, oh, my God, this guy played on this record. He also played on this stuff, too. And, man, how amazing would it be to be doing that, to be that guy? And lo and behold, thank my lucky stars, I managed to kind of get to a place where that became my life, you know. And so it was just kind of something that I always wanted to do. I love playing live, and I've done that over the years, too. But I was never a road dog that would go out, you know, a big tour for months and months and months, year after year. I was much more interested in creating a lasting body of music on records. And so I'm incredibly grateful that I got the opportunity to do that.
Well, you mentioned quite a bit of things there. But one of the things you mentioned just real briefly was your dad having perfect pitch. Yeah. Was that something that was passed down to you?
Unfortunately not. I have very good relative pitch. If I have a pitch reference, and you play much enough, I'll tell you what they are. But yeah, I never did get that perfect pitch gene. You know, it was pretty fun. He would play games with us. Like he would stand in the corner facing the wall and say, "Okay, play any seven notes," and I would just play the weirdest, most random notes I could play. And he'd come sit down and sort of make a piece out of it, you know. And so he was a talented, smart guy. But I did not get the perfect pitch gene. We used to have fun pranking, and we'd play organ at church, and it was a digital pipe organ, and we'd sneak in there and set the transpose switch just so that we sat down to play the prelude, and we'd pick the first chord and jump because the notes would be wrong.
That's too funny. I know my daughter just got her first guitar, and she's been trying to play, but I know nothing about guitar. I can't help her. All I can do is point her in the right direction or tell her if she's doing something right or wrong, but I can't show her. So to have somebody like that would be pretty cool. All right. So the other thing I wanted to know real quick was you mentioned the studios in Arizona.
Yes.
They've got to be probably comparative to LA and Nashville. We're probably talking about smaller studios, aren't we?
They were smaller studios, but they had the basic stuff. You know, they had a console and, you know, 24 track tape machines and lots of mics and all that stuff. And it's basically the same tools that you'd find in L.A. Of course, the bigger studios in L.A. have more of everything and more expensive versions of stuff, I'm sure. But it was a great proving ground for me and a place to learn, you know, because not only do you learn sort of the technical aspects of the process of recording and making a record, but you sort of learn the protocol and, like, how not to play too much, when to, you know, stay out of the way and so many other, tools of a recording session musician. And it really helped me a lot, so that when I got to L.A. and had a chance to go work sort of in the major leagues there, I had that kind of farm team experience in a small town, and it was incredibly lucky that it worked out.
So what type of recordings were you doing in Arizona before you took off?
Well, our little fusion band recorded some material. And other than that, there was some other bands in town that I would get hired to play with as a keyboardist, and a lot of sort of local jingles. And again, you know, none of this stuff.
That's pretty cool, too.
I mean, yeah, that actually came in handy later on in my career, after my L.A. period. I'm like one of those cat with nine lives. I've been doing this long enough to where I've had to kind of reinvent myself and make some big moves in my career when, for whatever reason, things changed and I felt like, I need to make a move in one way or another, geographically or musically, to stay relevant and you know, keep the work coming in. After my years in L.A., like basically the 80s and a little bit of the early 90s, after that I moved to San Francisco. I had an offer from a music house there that did a lot of commercials and TV scores and things like that. And they used to fly me up there to San Francisco to work for them and do stuff. And they always said, hey, man, if you ever decide to get tired of L.A. and you want to move up here and join us, we've got a place for you, and we'd love to have you as a member of our team. And, you know, L.A. was great for a guy like me in the 80s. There was a lot of pop records, a lot of artists that didn't have bands. And, you know, there was just a lot of studio musicians being used to record the pop music of the day. And then right around the 90s started, all of a sudden you had grunge bands and you had rap artists. And these guys didn't need pop players on their records, and the work got slow in LA for me, to the point where I started looking around thinking, man, I'm gonna have to make a move, I'm gonna have to do something. And I just remembered these guys in San Francisco, you know, they had a great scene up there, and I called them up one day and said, man, is that offer still stand? And they said, heck yeah. And I moved up there, and kind of the 90s I spent in the Bay Area, and it was, gosh, it was wonderful in so many ways. It's just, you know, beautiful area to live in. But every day was a different style of music. You know, one day it would be orchestral. The next day it would be like metal kind of style. The next day it would be Latin or just whatever. I mean, literally it was, you know, a different kind of music every day. And I'm never one of those guys that feels like I can rest on my laurels and I know enough, and you know, I like to keep learning and keep growing. And so that was an amazing opportunity for me. And I was sort of like the house engineer on top of everything else. So I was playing and programming and engineering and writing and all that stuff. And I learned so much. But once again, that whole situation kind of just faded away.
What was that like? What was going through your head?
I enjoyed it.
Were you nervous?
I mean, there'd be an occasionally a situation where I felt like, okay, now I'm really, really having to stretch here, and there's clients here, and they, you know, go in and play so and so on the piano. It's like, wow, that's not a style of music I'm real comfortable with. You know, there was days when I was definitely pushed out of my comfort zone, but I feel like that's super important and a good thing. You know, everybody needs to be shoved out of their comfort zone from time to time so that they grow. And truthfully, I loved it. The other thing about engineering that was really cool is you know, you're shaping sound, you're sculpting sound, and as a synth guy and programmer, it all sort of meshes together, you know. And I still work at home. Like half of my work is at home doing overheads. That's where I, you know, have still engineering. Sometimes I'll do things like string arrangements or whatever. I'll have a singer or string players, live players, singers come over, so I have to engineer that stuff. And so all those skills that are just invaluable, and they all kind of work hand in hand. For me, it's they're all important parts of the toolbox, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Now, I mean, it could be the commercials or the jingles and stuff, but what was your most memorable project from that time?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, in the 80s, L.A. period, the most memorable was probably the Stevie Nicks sessions, because it was kind of the first sort of big-time artist I had done something with. So it was really inspiring and amazing. And some of the stuff we did, you know, this one song, "Has Anyone Ever Written Anything For You," that was on that Rock and Roll album, was really just me on piano and her singing, and kind of went all night working on that thing, and it was just magical. Once I was doing the stuff in San Francisco, I don't know if I can pinpoint any one. It was
What was your biggest lesson?
Oh man. Well, you know, it was very client oriented. Ad agency people would come to the studio, and we had client days. I really learned a lot about servicing clients. This is not a musical thing, but again, this all factors into whatever you're doing in the music industry.
Oh, absolutely.
You've got to learn how to get along with people and be receptive to their ideas, even if they're just nuts, you know. Or you've got to learn how to sort of, okay, that's a great idea, and just figure out how to kind of work with it and make them feel good about, you know, what they're suggesting.
Well, that's a really good point too. You're working with corporate people who want things a certain way, and there's certain protocols and procedures you go through. Does that prepare you for what you eventually would go through in Nashville?
It does, in a way. Yeah, sure. All my experiences, like, that challenge me in different ways are preparing me for the next thing. I mean, even working for producers in L.A., the one guy I worked for, he was just exhausting and not fun to work for at all. He would just wear you out. Okay, we're going to do this until you're – and he would shout out ideas much faster than I could chase them, you know, making sounds and coming up with parts. So, you know, I was just kind of playing catch-up mentally the entire time. And it would go on for hours. At the end of that, he'd go, okay, now show me what you would do. And by that point, I was just like, basket case, you know. But that was really good training. It is – exhausting and painful as all that could be sometimes, it was great training. And once I moved to Nashville and started working for people like Dan Huff, it's like, oh my God, this guy is so easy to work for. He's so nice, and he really knows what he wants, and it just makes my job so much easier. I feel like all the difficult parts of my job kind of paved the way for me to really enjoy.
Of course. But even Nashville, I mean, you're talking about having a producer bark orders and, you know, try this.
Yeah.
Nashville is known for being very fast.
That's true.
And, I mean, I don't think they bark orders like that, but they're very fast. I mean, you have to go out in the room and you play something, and it could be the drop of a dime. All right, now play it in this key. Oh, yeah. And you, as a keyboard player, you don't have the luxury of a capo or anything.
Right.
So, I mean, how do you handle changes like that on the fly?
Well, it took me a while to adjust. I remember the first session I did here, there was another keyboard player on the session who was a great guy, super talented, ridiculously good player. He was playing piano, and I was asked to bring the synth in and play pads and stuff. And, you know, I never looked down at country players. It was never that. But I guess in some way I had this feeling, because, you know, okay, I've played some jazz fusion stuff, I've done rock and all these things, country's probably going to be pretty easy, you know. What an idiot, because, you know, I very quickly learned a few things. So on that first session, I'm, you know, playing my little pads, and the piano player's killing it, and the whole band's killing it. They play the song down to my ears flawlessly. I mean, like, holy crap, I've never heard a first take of anything just sound like the finished record, and everything sounded perfect. And Dan Huff, the producer, said, okay, that's great, guys. Let's try it up a half step. And I'm like, no way. Are you kidding? And they just did it. And it did it.
No warning whatsoever.
No worry. And in between takes, the piano player just peel off some incredible jazz stuff. And I'm like, okay, I got to rethink this. I'm actually in the deep end of the pool here. This is not, you know, like country is easy. That's that whole stupid thought that I had rattling around in my tin can of a brain. That was clearly wrong. And I learned so much very quickly moving here about how just because the part you're playing isn't a virtuoso part doesn't mean it isn't challenging, because the more you simplify music, the more you're left with the pocket has to be right. The sounds have to be just right. What you're playing, you have to be careful not to overplay, and you have to listen to everybody. And I mean, it just,
that's a great point too.
And Dan Huff, I mean, bless his heart. He's like, I'll probably say his name way too many times, but I should have a shrine in my house for this guy, because he was the first guy that hired me, in town and recommended me to lots of people, but it still took a while for me to get a lot of other clients. But he is the most just gentle teacher. I learned so much from him. I mean, he's an incredible player as well. But
he's an amazing player. People all know him for his production abilities, but he's an incredible player. I mean, he played in Giants, and that was an amazing band as well. I don't think he gets the credit that he deserves for that.
I first met Dan in the 80s when I was in L.A., doing keyboard sessions, and we didn't work together very many times, but a few times, you know, he would be the guitarist on the session, and he was always just a super nice guy, as he is, and an incredible player. When I was in San Francisco, and that whole scene kind of just went down the tubes, the dot-com crash happened, and all advertising agencies, just everything changed. They started using band tracks, a lot of them kind of went under, and the whole scene changed, and I kind of parted ways with the guy that I had been working with there. And so I kicked around for a little while, watching my savings dwindle, and thinking, okay, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And it was like, well, I guess, I don't know, let's check out Nashville. They still have a real, you know, thriving recording scene and it's like the only place now where records are made in the old school way of essentially a band recording on the floor and working out their parts, everybody playing off of each other and getting a good take. And we're still over now, most of the time. But anyway, I tracked Dan down and cold called him because I knew he was out here as a producer. And I'm thinking, he's not going to know who I am. I was scared. It took me like 3 days to screw up the courage to call him. And I called him up and said, Dan, you're not going to probably remember me. My name's Charlie Judge. I was a keyboard player in L.A., and we did some sessions together and, you know, blah, blah. He goes, oh, man, yeah, I know who you are, of course. And that stuff you did on blah, blah, blah was really cool and whatever. And he said, well, man, I'll tell you, there's a ton of great keyboard players here in Nashville, which that was for sure true. But he said, but nobody really does what you do. And he said, I would definitely hire you. And you know, that was the impetus for me to go, okay, I'm going to do it, you know, because I had to move my whole family out here. And gosh, it was just amazing that all worked out like that.
Well, I mean, he's 100% right. I mean, you do have this unique feel to you in Nashville. I mean, I've worked there for 20 plus years, and I've had the pleasure of working with yourself and a lot of others. But they come in, they play keyboards, they typically play piano on most of these country records, but you come in and in addition to playing keyboards or piano, you have the ability to play string parts, and you take the time to program stuff even on the fly. I don't think Nashville session players typically do things like that. I mean, I might be wrong, but it doesn't feel like that. I mean, what do you feel like makes you different?
That synth pop background that I had in LA probably is the thing that distinguishes me from the other players mostly. And I've always, like I said before, create my own sound libraries. And you know, like to get in under the hood of a sound and say, the sound is great, but I need to change the filter, maybe add a little motion to it, change the attack, and, you know, just at the very least, if I call up anything like a factory preset, I'm going to mess with it and change it. But, yeah, I was lucky enough that when I moved here, Shania Twain and some artists had been doing some stuff that really started pulling pop elements into the country world. You know, there's always that conflict between the sort of the purist world, because at the same time that was happening, the Dixie Chicks were huge, and so there was this also simultaneously a sort of a go back to the roots kind of a move. So, but yeah, I learned very quickly how to use synthesizers in a kind of an organic way that didn't sound like way out of place in a country or even a pretty acoustic record. Just learn to find ways to come up with sounds and parts that feel appropriate. You know, it's like a guitar sound or anything. There's no such thing as a bad sound. It's just what's appropriate.
An appropriate sound. Well, I like what you said there too, because there's no other keyboard player who can just turn on a preset and sound like what you've created, because you alter the presets. So I think that helps you stand out as well.
Another thing that I have always done is I get multiple things going on a recording take, so that, you know, maybe I find a pad, let's say I have to start with a pad sound of some sort, and I get that to where it's working. I feel like, okay, this is going to be great for the intro and the verses. Need a little something else for the next section. I'll come up with another layer to add on another keyboard. And then, like, maybe a cool pulsing sound in this section or whatever. So I get bored if I just have one sound. And so I always have them set me up with, like, three stereo pairs of outputs from my rig, and I'll just assign things so that they don't overlap, hopefully, or as little as possible. And so that I'm giving them a fuller picture of a final production right off the bat, because I think that does set me apart. Most other players will have a sound. And then once they're done with that, okay, now give me another track and I'll do something. And I do that too. But I really like to have more than one thing going on.
Bob Bullock was on the show last week, and he was talking about the Shania Twain records as well. And, you know, the amount of detail and stuff that went into those records of working with Mutt Lange.
Mutt Lange, yeah. Yes, I've never had the pleasure of working for Mutt Lange, but I've heard a lot of stuff about it, and everybody just has huge respect for him. He's the best.
He's
just, I mean, so detail oriented, and he makes great records.
So you moved to town. You're in Nashville, and you meet back up with Dan Huff. What was the first project you worked on?
Yeah, there were a couple of things. The first session I did was the one I mentioned, and it was Cliff Richard, of all people, come to town to do a few things. And there was also around the same time a duo called Evan and Jaron. And I'm not sure whatever happened to those guys. They were really talented. And Dan sent me several of their tracks to overdub on. I think he just wanted to kind of see what I would do if we just kind of gave me enough rope to hang myself, and like a bunch of songs, and which, you know, brings up an obvious point. Any musician that wants to be successful needs to have a home studio, however basic, enough to where you can do overdubs and you know, work at home. So I had my setup, and he sent me all these songs, and man, I went to town on this stuff. And you know, again, another. To me, this stuff is all obvious. I'm saying, like, this is some great wisdom. Well, it's pretty obvious, but I always try to do more than what's expected of me. I don't want to ever feel like I got away with, you know, just doing the basic stuff. And so, especially if I'm working at home overdubbing, I'm not clock watching. I would much rather spend twice as much time as I'm billing for and have them think I'm a genius and they want to hire me again next time, you know? And plus, working at home, when there's you're not watching the clock and nobody's looking over your shoulder, it's an opportunity for me to experiment and try different sounds and do stuff that would be like, yeah, it's a little daunting to pull up on a live session and jump into those waters. But I'm here, I've got time, nobody's looking at me. I'm just going to try some weird stuff or just something that's outside the box of what I would normally, you know, have in my...
Get to woodshed with your own gear.
Yeah. So I did just a ton of overdubs on these songs and brought my little disc drive up to Dan at his home studio. And he was sitting with me and going through it all. And you know, I guess it worked. I was successful in demonstrating here's some stuff that I can do that he's not used to hearing in Nashville from the keyboard guys that he has been working with. So I knew this was an opportunity. I need to really kind of strut my stuff a little bit. So I did all the stuff for him. And I think that gave him the comfort to then call me for a Faith Hill record that was happening the next thing he had coming up. So I think he's kind of trying me out a little bit there.
Of course.
And yes, as he should. But it all worked out. And so Faith Hill was probably the first major artist that I got to record in Nashville once I moved here. And it's funny, after I did that, I thought, okay, I'm in the club. I'm like, you know, they're going to call me now. Well, I was wrong. Surprise. And stupid as usual. It was like, Dan would call me once a month or something. I'd get to work on something amazing. And then I would sit at home and the phone would not ring. And Dan all along was telling me, man, I'm throwing your name around like a rag doll. I'm telling everybody about you. And they weren't calling me. At least at first.
So what was the breaking point?
The breaking point was that I had I'd met a background singer on the Faith Hill record. And she was doing some live stuff at Third Wednesday, a local Nashville, you know, live music venue bar, and asked me to play with her and live show. And so I went and did some nights with her, and that was my first live playing in Nashville. Well, lo and behold, at the end of one of those sets, somebody approached me from the audience and said, hey man, do you do demos? And I'm like, I guess, whatever, you know. Sure. I mean, I don't know what you're asking me exactly, but the answer is always yes. So yes. And so I showed up at a session, and it was my first demo session. And doing that, I realized, oh, the light bulb went off. Like, oh, there's this whole other industry here besides the big major label albums that are happening of publishing demos and, you know, songwriters recording their songs to make them sound as record-like as they can in a short amount of time to feed them to artists that are looking for material for their next record. And so I eventually learned, I kind of snuck in the back door with the whole Dan Huff thing, and then once I got into the demo world too, it became obvious that's the farm team for the major league record world. And that's how players would normally work their way up the ranks. And so I did that too, in addition to getting record work, thankfully.
Also fills in the holes.
It fills in the holes, yeah. And you get to know the other players in town, and the word gets out and people start to recognize your name. And so that eventually filled in the gaps, and eventually I got very fortunate and got to work with, you know, tons of people. But that's how it started. And it's sadly, I don't know that the demo thing is what it was back then. Now there's still some of that going on, but a lot of stuff is just being done by writers who, a lot of the co-writers now have probably most of them came from LA and stuff, but they're called track guys. And they kind of have a lot of the skill sets that I have. They program sounds and beats and whatnot, and they're kind of on the floor with the other co-writers who are doing lyrics and melodies, and usually I should just put tracks together in the background. By the end of the day, they have what sounds like a record, and the record labels and the publishing companies like, well, heck, we don't need to go in and record a demo now because we have, you know, we have a recording that sounds great. And those guys are, I mean, it's funny, like a lot of people kind of like to poo-poo the track guys. Maybe they're jealous or I don't know. But, man, I think there's unbelievable talent in this town a lot of these guys won't make it sick.
Well, I'm sure it's a talent. It's just the fact that they're stealing work is the way it feels to the traditionalists.
Yeah. It's funny. There are a lot of them aren't really, some of them are great musicians. They'll play guitar and keys and everything. But some of them just do what they call paint. They just drag and drop stuff. But they just, man, they have a way of putting really cool sounds together. And even if they don't know how to program sound, I mean, nowadays, anything you buy has thousands of presets. And
right.
You don't really have to make sounds from scratch. You can just keep hunting and pecking until you find something that fits great.
Or layer things so they sound different.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of times we go and record the record now, we'll have all those tracks. And sometimes we use some of it. Sometimes we start from scratch. But I'm always really impressed with the talent level. And it's cool because these guys are now, they're using sounds that I know I couldn't have gotten away with when I first moved to town, you know.
You mean very pop-sounding stuff?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. A lot of these demos are just all pop-sounding, and then we kind of have to bring it back to earth, kind of all the organic stuff. Why this was guitars, bass, drums, D3.
Well, that's what Nashville is based on, right?
Yeah.
Traditional instruments and everything. It's good to be able to program something and give people ideas, but it all comes back to that live band in the studio, those eight guys playing at one time. And
that's right.
I think that's what the magic is.
I was going to say that exact word, that just the magic happens there. There's just something about playing off of other people, the inspiration of that and the spontaneity of it that you just can't get with one guy sitting in front of the screen, no matter how great the sounds are.
So what was it like working with some of these artists? You said you're working with Dan Huff, and he's putting together Faith Hill, and I know you've even recently worked with Tim McGraw. What was that like?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's wonderful. Gosh. You know, it's, I have to say, almost without exception, I'm not going to trash anybody, but all these artists have really been a joy to hang out with and work with. They're really down-to-earth people. I think a lot of the ones that are so big, you just think, oh, they could be jerks if they wanted to be jerks, but they're not, you know? And, Tim McGraw is just like salt of the earth, nicest guy. He's just really generous, and he just wants the music to be great. He gives all the players and producers a lot of freedom to kind of find their way musically, but he's definitely got an opinion, and he will work things in and you know, assert his personality, put a stamp on anything. He's a great one. He's a great example. But man, I've had almost always great experiences in this town. These artists.
Tim's known for fighting for his band to be able to go into the studio with them. So
that's true too.
Was that part of your experience?
Some of them. Bass player Paul Bushnell and sometimes some of the guitar players are on the record a lot. Yeah. And in this case, the drummer Shannon Forrest was also the main engineer and the studio owner. I mean, talk about ridiculous skill set. but we worked at his studio to make that record. So me and Shannon were kind of more like studio guys.
Well, there's one artist that, matter of fact, it's the very first artist I worked with when I moved to Nashville was Keith Urban. I know you've had a chance to do quite a bit of work with Keith. Can you tell me your experiences there?
Oh, man. I mean, he's like a force of nature. The talent's just
oozing out.
Shooting out of his fingertips like lightning bolts, this guy. And he's, you know, I have so much respect for a lot of these artists. He's one of these guys, too, that he doesn't settle. He never settles for anything. It's like he's always trying to push a little further. I think this could be a little bit better. Or let's try it a different way. It's like, and like you do something, and you'll, at the end of the day, you think, man, this turned out amazing. Next thing you know, we're starting over. We're going to redo it. Like, yeah, okay. But it's wonderful. And it's great to work with artists that can, you know, I guess they have the budgets to be able to do that stuff. But yeah, I mean, his standards are really high. And when he's chasing something, sometimes, you know, it's difficult to articulate exactly what he's going for, because, you know, we're talking about music, and there's never just the right adjectives you're looking for when you're trying to describe something. But, him and Dan have worked together a lot, and so they're pretty good.
Two powerhouses for sure.
Yeah, oh my gosh. But yeah, Keith is, I mean, geez, it's just amazing to watch him, you know. Sometimes he'll throw a bass part down, and it'll be like, we did one song that like you play the bass on just kind of throwing a couple things down real quick to just kind of give us a basis of something to hear and absorb and play to. Well, I ended up being the bass part on the record, and you know, he'll play guitar. Obviously, his guitar playing is ridiculous. And his singing,
amazing.
He really is.
You don't expect that out of, you know, your typical artist in Nashville. You don't expect him to be such a great guitar player in addition to that.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of them like that. Brad Paisley, another guy.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, you know, Dan Huff, gosh, when he started not playing on the floor as much as he used to when I first moved here, but it's always a treat when he's playing with us as he's producing. I've never seen anybody do what he does where he'll be playing an acoustic guitar part and just nail it, of course, and stand up. And at the end of the take, he then will, in the headphones, go around and say, Charlie, that was a little too much in verse two. I want you to do this and that. The drummer, the kick drum pad in here needs to change. He will have digested what everybody else played as he's executing his part flawlessly. Anyway, yeah, so there is so much talent in this city. It's very humbling.
So when you're playing with Keith, what's it like for you? What's your role like during those sessions?
Well, I'm listening very attentively to everything that comes out of his mouth and everything that he plays us.
Is he co-producing the project?
He is more so lately, I think, in the last few records.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, goodness, he certainly got... Well, there's no reason why he shouldn't. He's got the goods. He's proven himself, so he's earned the right. It's always challenging when, as a keyboard player that does synth stuff, especially a lot of synth stuff, you kind of have to guess. You know, like, okay, well, maybe this would fit. You know, and a lot of times you get shot down. Like, that's not the right. You're in the wrong sort of category of sounds there, man. You know, okay, sorry, let me try this. And, but I'll tell you, it is challenging. It's so challenging. Like, you'll listen to the demo, you're in the control room listening, you've got a chart, you're reading the chart, you're just kind of trying to absorb a little bit about what is the song, what's the style of it, what is maybe something I could try. And then you've got precious little time to get saddled up and be ready to play, because I'll try to sneak out of the control room like before the song, you know, gets to the outro or whatever. Just kind of, I got to get in front of my rig, put on my headphones,
start dialing things in,
come up with something. And it never fails. As soon as I do that, everybody follows me in there, and the drummer's whacking on the stereo, and the guitar player's rah, rah, rah. And I mean, you can't, it's really hard to hear. And on top of that, I've got to come up with, like I'm saying, like three or four things, because I'm not going to settle for just a single sound. Sometimes it just, I can't quite pull all these things together in time, and we just start recording. And the first pass is me just kind of like, just trying to hang on by thread and just kind of get through the song and get one or two things working. And it'll take a few takes before I kind of have got my little world, you know, dialed in.
Set up and dialed in.
Yeah.
And that's the great thing about this is a lot of people don't realize that the speed things move in Nashville. I mean, when you're listening to the demo,
most
of the time you don't even finish the entire listen before you're back in the room playing.
Yeah. And having come from, well, the LA situation in the 80s, I mean, we show up kind of loosely at 11 or 12 maybe, and they would work on a snare drum sound for 2 or 3 hours. We'd sit
right.
Lobby and hang out, and I mean, it, you know, maybe by the end of the night we get one song or something. And so when I came to Nashville, and it was like, no, we're doing on a master, you know, three songs today. I was like, wow, that's a lot. And then, you know, a demo session, we're doing six songs in 3 hours. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Ah. Right.
So it was an adjustment for sure.
That's a lot of my world was a demo world, moving fast. And, you know, I got told plenty of times that time is money and, yeah. you know, have the right microphones in the right place at the right time. And they better be live and ready to go. And,
oh, well, I was just going to sing your praises, and anybody else in Nashville that's an engineer, or especially an assistant, like, which is, they're actually going running Pro Tools and setting up the mics and doing all the really, a lot of times, the heavy lifting. I, to this day, I don't know how they keep up. I mean, someone will say, hey, punch me in like 2 bars before the chorus. Okay.
Okay. Got it.
You know, they're on it. They're
like, yeah. Anyway, so, I didn't learn that until working for Bob Bullock. I mean, I've worked with a few people in Nashville. You know, I've studied under three producers in Nashville, but Bob Bullock was the one who taught me time was money, because we were in the middle of a Travis Tritt session, and one of the headphones went out in the live room. So, like a good boy does, I'm out in the room and quick as can be, and changing the headphones out, and then I'm back in the control room. We go red, and we're going, and then the headphone box goes out again. So he's like, go. And I'm like, we're out of headphones. He's like, you should add two out there. Go. I'm like, okay. So I'm out there with my headphones, plugging them in. Here you go. And then after that session, I was told, you know, hey, time is money. It's not just the broken headphones. It's the eight people in the room. It's their fee for that time. It's the studio time. It's the time for you. It's the time for me. It's and just on and on. And it all adds up. But like you were saying, I grew up in Boston, and I worked in Boston and New York, and we wouldn't even go in the studio until 10 o'clock at night. And it was very laid back and very slow, and we would try things, and we'd go in and have the band set up and however long that takes. And there was no union type pace. And then I moved to Nashville, and like I said, when I was working for Bob, it was go, 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 go. So it took a while, and then eventually got to go out on my own. But if it wasn't working for Bob, I don't think I would have ever lasted in Nashville. Yeah. No, that time is money. is no joke. Well, I have a few more things I want to make sure we have time to touch on.
Okay. Sure.
One, I know my daughters would kill me if I didn't ask you what it was like working on a Taylor Swift project.
Well, it was great fun. It was mostly the album called Red. I met her at a Christmas party a few years before that. She was nice as can be. It was just funny because she walked in and she looked so familiar to me. I just assumed, and I'm terrible about remembering names and stuff. I didn't know who she was, but I knew that she was familiar. So I assumed I'd work with her, and she was walking in a room hugging people that she knew. And I just, hey, and she gave me a big hug like she knew me. She played right along. She was, really cool. A lot of my buddies have been in studio with her a lot, and she's the real deal. She's a genuine, down to earth, great person.
So, what parts did you play?
Oh, I did. Everything from accordion to RB3 and a lot of synth stuff, all textural parts. So it was really cool. overdub kind of stuff.
So playing accordion, I mean, I know you play everything, but playing an accordion, what's that like in a studio these days?
Well, there's real accordion players out there. Jeff Taylor is sort of the gold standard there. I don't use the chord buttons or the bass buttons in the left hand. All my left hand does is push the bellows in and out. So I play the keyboard with the right hand.
And
thankfully, in the style of music that I play, country and pop stuff, it's not polka, so or whatever. You don't have to do all that stuff with the left hand. So thank goodness, you know, I was able to find a way to get some good use out of it without being an amazing accordion player. Well, God forbid, one of those ones with the buttons and no keys, I wouldn't know how to start doing.
That's fine. That was my mother's instrument growing up in school, was accordion.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I play some keyboards, not anything like you, but that's the instrument I started on and studied on. And I could never play an accordion. Never. It's just like you said. I don't know what those buttons do.
It takes a little getting used to. I mean, the B3 was kind of. I played a little bit. I had one in California that I played once in a blue moon. You know, like I said, every day is different. So B3 was rarely called for. So I didn't grow up playing that. When I moved to Nashville and started playing country records, I just jumped right in. Okay, I'm playing B3. Luckily, I had a kind of an affinity for the instrument, and I discovered that it's a really cool instrument. It's very forgiving. You don't have to do a lot to sound good. You can just kind of
turn this. It's awesome.
Speed, and it sounds great, you know. It really is such a cool instrument.
That is such a great instrument. I've had the pleasure of having you on a couple of the projects that I produced. And one of them was for an artist called Maddie McCree. And we went in, I think it was over at Master Phonics Studio 6, if I'm remembering correctly. But you came in and you played keyboards. And there was two tracks on there that were very heavily piano. One of them was almost entirely piano that you just stepped in and sat down and played the piano. It just sounded beautiful. But then there was a couple, you broke out that B3 and holy cow, it was like glue, and it was that magic. Yeah. And it sounded awesome.
It is
still one of my favorite projects.
That's an amazing instrument, combination of that and the Wesley speaker. God, it just always sounds great. And it kind of comes in and out of favor over the years. For a while, we didn't do it very much, but now it's back again. And it's just one of those things that will warm up a track and give it some organic life. And, you know, especially with a lot of these poppy tracks that, you know, we do a lot of synth stuff, you know, that B3 kind of really helps bridge the gap.
It's like glue, but it also can be just aggressive if played right. So, I mean,
yeah.
It has a hell of a personality to it.
It does, and it doesn't
sound, you know, corny or cheesy. It just sounds like something that belongs there.
Yeah. You know? I love it.
And then the other thing you mentioned too is doing a lot of work out of your home. But I had you come in and play on a project for a girl named Tristan Burke. And it was a project we had already recorded. We had recorded it somewhere off the row. And I sent the tracks over to you. And that was the first time I've ever done that. Send tracks and just, well, let's see what we get back. But yeah. I mean, you put together some amazing stuff, piano tracks, and but you came up with some synth parts that were just killer. And I mean, I'll never forget it. Working with you has truly been a joy in my time, whether it be working for Bob Bullock or some of these others, but also having the opportunity to bring you on my own. So I really do appreciate
that. Thank you so much. Gosh, it's likewise, man. It's an honor and a pleasure. With synth parts, to me, it's like orchestration in a way. When I layer them, it's trying to find things that, you know, don't sort of step on each other in the same space and kind of fit together and complement each other.
Well, what I like about the way you do it is, a lot of people, when they put synths or keyboard parts into music, it instantly gives that 80s feel or, you know, more of a pop feel. But you have a way of being able to put it into organic country track and have it fit. And like, it just glues things together and just sounds awesome. So that's what I appreciate about it. I think it takes a little bit extra thought to be able to do that.
Well, thank you so much. That's been always a challenge. And one of the first things that I realized, I better figure out, you know, how to make this stuff work in this context. Because, you know, since they were not going to go away, but I've heard other people do some stuff. It's like, wow, that doesn't fit, man.
No, it could easily date something, too.
That's true, too. Certain sounds can be very time stamped, and got to be careful with that.
All right, sir. Well, we do this thing here called Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to recognize somebody who works behind the scenes, gives you support. Mm. It could be anybody from an engineer or an assistant. It could be somebody in your personal life, like your wife or a family member. Is there anybody that you'd like to shine a little light on?
Oh my goodness. Well, really, I think it's all the assistant engineers. I mean, you know, there's so many of them. I don't want to name names because I'll leave some out.
Of course.
You know, But as I was talking about earlier, those guys are the, to me, are the unsung heroes on Music Row. These guys, they're the first guys to show up, the last guys to leave. They're the hardest working guys in there. They make the least amount of money, I'm sure, on the session. And they're so fast and so knowledgeable. It's, I mean, they know the console. They know all the outboard gear, the mics. It's just incredible how good and smart these guys are, and their work ethic is just off the charts. And that should be an inspiration to all of us, man. Just knowing your craft, working your butt off, never complaining. And I mean, they deserve a lot of credit that they don't typically get.
I agree with you 100%. Not only because I spent a lot of time as an assistant myself, but because I've had assistants of my own that I know the struggle they're going through because I've been there, and I know the struggle because of what I'm asking of them to do. And You're right. Just having knowledge of the console should be enough, but then you have to have the knowledge of the console in the studio next door and the one down the street and the one over here.
Yes.
And then the microphone closet for each one of those rooms. And
that's right. The patch bay, the outboard. Yeah. Oh my God. It just goes on and on.
Right. It's crazy. So on that note, any advice you'd give to somebody who's looking to take your place?
Well, I mean, it's all this sort of cliche stuff, you know. Always give more than the required amount. Try to make an impression. Like, you have to learn, no matter what it is you're recording, if you think, oh, man, this song is a piece of crap, this artist can't sing, whatever it is, find something to love about, so that you're excited about contributing and you're giving it your best effort. Don't just phone it in. Work on your sound. Have really good sounds. Be, you know, easy to get along with. Be enthusiastic. Be willing to do favors for people. I mean, you know, just, you know, there's so many ways that if you do all that kind of stuff, the object is, you want them to call you next time instead of the other guy, right? So you got to stand out by your work ethic, your sounds, your musicianship, your parts. Listen to what everybody else is playing. Listen to the vocal. Pay attention to what's the song about. I mean, it's really obvious, and it's easy to sort of kind of just coast and not do all that stuff. But I'm telling you, man, you got to really care. You got to find a way to keep caring. And giving it your best.
Charles, sir, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you here. I would like to leave the final words to you.
Gosh. Well, thank you so much for having me, Jay. This is really cool, man. And, you know, all I can say is I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I got to do what I wanted to do, which is play music on records. And it took a while to get there. So anybody out there that wants to do that, don't give up, man. Keep putting it out there. Work hard. Set yourself apart from your competitors. And just keep pushing, man.
Now, I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. Charles is not only an amazing musician, but he's a great inspiration and a great friend. So please join me in giving him a big thanks for taking the time to share his stories with us. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode29. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.